Today at Reader's Corner, an encore presentation of my conversation with Elizabeth Economy, author of The Third Revolution, Xi Jinping and the New Chinese State. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. China is a nation in pursuit of a new role on the global stage. But what implications will those reversing trends have on the U.S. and the rest of the world? In her new book, The Third Revolution, Elizabeth Economy provides an incisive look at the transformative changes underway in China today. Chinese leader Xi Jinping has unleashed a powerful set of political and economic reforms, the centralization of power, the expansion of the Communist Party's role in Chinese political, social, and economic life, and the construction of a virtual wall of new regulations surrounding both capital and ideas. Elizabeth Economy is the C.V. Starr Senior Fellow and Director for Asian Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and a distinguished visiting fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. A frequent guest and commentator on Chinese domestic and foreign policy, she is also the author of By All Means Necessary, How China's Resource Quest is Changing the World. Elizabeth Economy, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much, Bob. Great to be here.
So let's start with Second Revolution, Elizabeth. Tell us a little bit about what happened under Deng Xiaoping's leadership, and then we can get into why Xi Jinping seems to be taking things in a different direction.
Sure. So the book is called The Third Revolution because it really is looking to underscore just how significant the change is from the Deng era to the Xi era. And if you look back at the Deng Xiaoping period, roughly starting from 1979 and then continuing through successive leaders until the advent of Xi Jinping in 2012, you see, Deng was all about reform and opening up, right? And he began by moving away from the Maoist sort of one-man centralized form of control over the Communist Party to embrace a much more collective form of decision-making, where he shared decisions with others in the Standing Committee of the Politburo. He opened up China to external influences, right? Deng Xiaoping believed that China had a lot to learn from the international community. He embraced foreign capital coming into China. He also began to open the Chinese system to the market, right? He launched the period of reform and opening up was all about opening up China to the market, to the marketplace in terms of the economy, but also the marketplace of ideas. And this was a period moving into the 1990s when China began to get its first non-governmental organizations and civil society began to blossom. And then he also, very famously, of course, said that China should maintain a low-profile foreign policy. Right? He wanted to focus on taking care of what was going on inside China, raising the living standards of the Chinese people. He didn't want a lot of Chinese adventurism, didn't want a lot of problems outside China that he would have to deal with. He really wanted to develop China economically and politically, at home. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of the Deng era. And then she came in, as you suggested, really had a fairly transformative effect on China.
And tell us a little bit about the challenges that he faces when, in fact, he's representing an illiberal state seeking leadership in a liberal world order.
So I think, when Xi Jinping came to power, he, basically looked around and said China faced a number of challenges. He felt like corruption needed to be addressed. If he didn't address it, it would be potential to be the end of the Chinese Communist Party, or even the end of the Chinese state. He felt like the economy, was slowing down, but it was also running amok. The party was basically a vehicle for individual Chinese to advance their personal careers and economic gains. There was no real central guiding communist theory or philosophy around which Communist Party members would gravitate. And he really clamped down. So he became far more repressive. He reverted back to a one-man form of rule. He began to reassert the power of the Communist Party back into the economy, back into Chinese people's life. Much more constrained internet, much tighter control over non-governmental organizations. I think a type of political repression, as you say, an illiberal state, than anybody could have imagined looking back at what China looked like in 2010, 2011. So to project that Chinese state now, right, an illiberal state in a liberal world order, you know, Xi Jinping has adopted a much more assertive foreign policy, right? That's another change from the Deng era, is that he's far more interested in advancing China's role economically, politically, and in terms of security. And I think while people are very familiar with sort of China's economic role on the global stage, many people will know that it's, you know, the largest trading partner for many countries globally. Its reach now extends through Africa and Asia, Latin America. It has its Belt and Road Initiative. All of this, I think, is, you know, very easy to see, you know, in the Western media and elsewhere. I think fewer people are aware of just how much Xi Jinping is also increasing China's profile politically, right? And the fact that he, to some extent, is exporting elements of China's authoritarian political model, right? And training officials in other countries on how to manage dissent, on how to control the internet, and expanding China's footprint through its military, through the control of ports, having People's Liberation Army Navy ships pay port visits. China's established its first base in Djibouti in Africa. It's talking about, you know, scores of more bases to come. So he really is not afraid, right? He's not ashamed of China's illiberal political state. He is very aggressively pushing China out into the world and trying to change the narrative about China at the same time. And so does he face challenges? Absolutely. And I think a lot of these stem from the types of things that he's doing at home, you know, with regard to Xinjiang. Between 1 million, 2 million Uyghurs have been detained. So there's a lot going on that's causing him problems. But he himself, I think, is a very assertive leader, and he's pushing China very much out on the global stage. Mm-hmm.
There are many ways to push China out on the global stage. He is obviously doing it with lots of money. And you have one section in your book where you talk about an exchange that the Singapore president had with an American, and the Singapore president was saying, well, you know, America just doesn't know how to deal internationally. When China comes to the table, it comes to the table with what you called in that section, bearing gifts. Could you address, I mean, obviously these things you're talking about, the military base in Djibouti in Africa, I mean, these things cost money. So this is a guy who's extending China's largesse significantly.
He is. And the Belt and Road Initiative, which he announced in 2013, just about a year after he came to power, it is this whole idea of connecting China, you know, more tightly to the rest of the world through the rejuvenation of the old Silk Road and the maritime spice routes. And it began with that idea, with sort of six economic corridors, and now it's expanded to include the entire world, is the biggest manifestation of this type of largesse, right? So it's China going out and doing enormous amounts of hard infrastructure building, you know, in other countries, ports and railroads and pipelines, airports, highways, and at the same time now a digital infrastructure, right, laying fiber optic cables, doing e-commerce and satellite systems. He wants a polar belt to connect China through Europe more directly. So China is lending an extraordinary amount of money. What it's not doing, and what has become clear over the past 5 to 6 years since the Belt and Road first began, is it's not necessarily investing as much money as people anticipated in these projects and in these countries. And so, you know, it invests maybe only $10 to $15 billion annually in these infrastructure projects, but it's lending. And it's lending on terms that is now causing a lot of consternation in many countries. And we see protests in a lot of these countries. We see countries like Malaysia, where Prime Minister Mahathir has clawed back some of the projects, Pakistan as well. So a number of China's neighbors and closest allies are beginning to say, you know what, China's bearing all these gifts, but there's a huge catch attached to this. And we saw that in Sri Lanka, where, you know, China's building the port, but because Sri Lanka couldn't pay the interest on the debt that had assumed from China, China has now taken control of the port itself and has a 99-year lease. And so this kind of debt for equity, for either natural resources or for land, for ports or for some of this infrastructure that Chinese labor is building, that these countries are paying China to do, has become a source of a lot of concern among many of these countries.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Elizabeth Economy, author of The Third Revolution. You point out in your book that China is great at innovation, but not so much at invention. Help us understand the difference there and what holds them back as far as invention is concerned.
Right. So this, I think, is a kind of an interesting and important distinction to make, that China does an enormous amount of innovation, what is sometimes termed process innovation. China's very good at making things, you know, run more quickly, at doing things for less, at responding to customers' needs. Xiaomi, the phone company, created something like 50 new models in the course of 1 year in response to consumer demand. The kind of ecosystem that they've set up, where the, you know, the labs and the manufacturing centers are all located within the same region, means that things are moving very quickly, right? And they're doing things very cheaply and at fairly significant scale. But what they're not very good at is invention, that kind of breakthrough technology. And if you talk to people like, you know, the great artist Ai Weiwei, or some, you know, venture capitalists in the United States, or even, you know, Chinese scientists themselves, they'll say, you know, there are definitely things that are holding them back, right? Their educational system, the lack of interconnectivity via the internet, many of the baseline cornerstones of what allows freedom and creativity to blossom and to grow, those things are constrained in China. And that's why invention is limited. Innovation is not limited. But that kind of invention that causes people to do things that may run counter to accepted practice or to accepted norms or ideas, that is not necessarily something that the Chinese system supports. So that's an area where I think they continue to run into some challenges. And that's why in the research for the book, I spoke with one of the founders of Baidu, and he said to me, you know, I wanted to come back to China. I'm a nationalist, you know, even though he received his graduate education in the United States. He said, but, you know, basically anybody who wants to do basic research, fundamental research, knows that the best place to do that is the United States.
Well, anybody listening to this conversation from Idaho, and Boise in particular, the headquarters of Micron Technology, would probably say, well, sure, they don't have to do invention. They steal that from those who are trying to come into the company and do business. And I'm sure you're aware of Micron and other companies who have had their issues with China as
Absolutely.
Far as intellectual property rights are concerned.
Absolutely. And I have to say, I think if there's one area in which the Trump, well, not even just one, but I think this is an area where the Trump administration is right to say enough is enough.
Yeah.
You know, we've in the United States have for a very long time now said, okay, you know, China is still a developing country. It's still learning how to adapt to international norms and practices, and we're going to cut it some slack. And, you know, a big argument in the sort of China community is always, well, as soon as China has its own intellectual property to protect, it's going to do a good job of protecting intellectual property.
Right, right.
But what we've seen is that China's perfectly good at protecting its intellectual property and still good at stealing the intellectual property of others. And so I think that argument no longer holds water. And so to the extent that the Trump administration is really trying to hold the Chinese to account, right, and say this behavior has to end or you're going to face economic consequences, I think they're on the right track. So there's no doubt that the Chinese have not moved quickly enough in the right direction on this front, and Micron is a good example of that.
You touched on the talent issue just briefly in one of your answers, but I want to underscore a number that really shocked me. I mean, I know there are people in China who leave to come over here to be educated or whatever and never go back. As a matter of fact, even though it's not China, Micron CEO is Indian-American who came over here to get three PhDs or to get 3 degrees, including his PhD at Berkeley. And today he's the CEO of Micron. But you talk about a brain drain as far as talent is concerned in China and point out that 4 million leave a year and something like 2.2 come back. Are they making any progress? I mean, we hear news stories of how Chinese are returning. That certainly must have something to do with this issue of invention.
I think that the reason that more Chinese are returning or are going to be returning now has a lot to do with the part of the Trump administration approach to China that isn't necessarily so good, or perhaps has been a little bit too extreme, which is to say, you know, we're very concerned about, you know, all Chinese, you know, graduate students, postdocs, scientists working in U.S. labs and university labs and, you know, national labs, et cetera. And I think there's a sense now emerging among many Chinese in the sciences in particular that they're not welcome here, that everyone is viewed with suspicion. All Chinese are considered to be spies. I think this is very problematic. It's something that we need to address absolutely, because it is clear that the Chinese government, you know, does call upon Chinese students and professors to, you know, serve the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation and bring back advances in technology from other countries. But definitely all Chinese are not doing this. And we need to find a way to sort of separate those from who are here and want to contribute to the United States in a positive way and those who are here for more malign reasons. But I think as long as the sort of temperature and political atmosphere in the United States continues to worsen for the Chinese, we will see more Chinese returning home.
So that 2.2 million may be going up instead of down.
Yes, and fewer will come to begin with, I think. That'll be the other side of it.
Just a couple of times now, President Trump's come into our conversation, and I was fascinated by a debate that you had with a gentleman on the issue of what happens when President Trump, with his America First campaign, sends messages to global partners that the U.S. isn't as interested as it used to be in the liberal world order, and it's not going to be out there doing as much as it did, and now she will fill the void. And
right.
You took the position that she will not necessarily fill the void. Explain.
That's right. And I think I've been bored out over the past 6 years that I'm right, I have to say. I think there was this natural assumption that because China's the second largest economy, because Xi Jinping, you know, tries to claim the global stage, you know, talking at Davos, you know, China's a champion of globalization, saying that China's a defender of climate change, that somehow just because Xi Jinping is claiming this space, just because he says these things, that actually that is what he does. And in point of fact, China is not a champion of globalization. It doesn't allow for the free flow of capital or the free flow of ideas. It is not a dominant defender of climate change. While it does invest more in renewable energy than any country, its CO2 emissions have increased both of the past 2 years. It's exporting over 100 coal-fired power plants globally through its Belt and Road program. And there's no sense in which China is stepping up to create new and positive international agreements on big issues like climate change or refugees. So while it is the case that the U.S. has, I would say, unfortunately, abdicated a large part of its leadership role on the global stage, it is also the case that China has not stepped up to fill that void and doesn't really show, I think, any of the true commitment or even possibly the ability to do that.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Elizabeth Economy, author of The Third Revolution. In the book, Economy looks at China's changing role on the international stage, led by President Xi Jinping. One of the things we hear a lot about, and I'm sure that when President Xi travels the world, he has to deal with the fact that in a day and age when the internet is so critical to invention and innovation, he basically controls it. And I wonder if you could help us understand, maybe through the case of Michael Ante, I think his name is, just what's going on over there as far as internet freedom is concerned. At one point, I think you say that she is preventing the internet from being the, quote, political change accelerator.
So if you look back to 2009, 10, 11, you would see that the internet in China was a very vibrant political space. You know, in many respects, things that, you know, couldn't take place in the real political world in China were happening on the internet, right? So people who were being unjustly accused of crimes by local politicians, for example, you know, the internet, people on the internet would pick up their cases, right, and investigate them and go after the local officials. When there were floods in Beijing, the entire community in Beijing would come together to help people out. This is the kind of stuff that you'd never see happening in China before. You had lawyers, right, connecting via the internet, and human rights activists meeting in the evenings. They'd have dinner, but they'd connect via the internet and talk about how to advance political reform in China. There was so much political activity occurring via the internet. Then you had Xi Jinping come in. And from the minute that he took power, the internet began to become a much more constrained political space. He passed a series of laws that made it illegal, right, to pass information that was considered to be a rumor. I think the perfect example is you look back just now, I guess, a year and a half or two ago to some floods that occurred in northern China. And two women, so as I mentioned in Beijing, when these floods happened, the community came together. People said, come stay at my home and I'll come rescue you from the airport. But in the floods just 2 years ago or so, two women were simply talking about the possibility that disease, in a private WeChat, in a private internet communication, were talking about the possibility that disease might be transmitted, and they were arrested. So I think the shift now, where everybody's afraid, there is no safe space on the Chinese internet for private communication, it has been dramatic. And Michael Anti, the case of Michael Anti, who for most of his adult life has been a very strong advocate of a greater free and open internet, today he says there really is no point. Nothing can be done under Xi Jinping, and he switched his efforts now to work on educating Chinese companies about the Belt and Road. Mm-hmm. And he was a very important and significant voice for internet freedom in China in the years before Xi Jinping. So it's not to say that people can't find out what's going on. It's not to say that they don't use virtual private networks to access information outside China, but it is much more difficult today than it was before the advent of Xi Jinping.
My next question really isn't necessarily about your book, although there was a line in your book that causes me to ask this question. I think I read somewhere about Google coming into China, sitting down with China to adjust its framework for this more repressive approach. And I read that and I thought, oh, now let me think. Google is an American company, founded in America. I get the fact that it's a multinational corporation, but what should be the role of these companies? At what point should they be in there aiding and abetting a dictator? He's not called that very often, but much of what you're describing here in this book suggests that he's got a firm control over his country and over the free expression of ideas. Do you have any comments on that?
Sure. I mean, I think this is a really essential, it's an important question, and Google came under a lot of criticism, in particular because at the same time as it was developing its strategy for getting back into China, it was telling the U.S. government that it wouldn't be interested in a contract in any sort of working with the U.S. Defense Department. So people were a little bit puzzled, right, by the fact that, you know, you won't work with a Democrat, your own Democratic government, but you will, in fact, go and do business and acquiesce to the demands of this, you know, very repressive, politically repressive government. And I think many Google employees were, in fact, unhappy with this decision. You know, I think every company is going to make its own determination about the lines that it's willing to cross or not cross. And in an earlier incarnation of Google, they made the determination to pull out because of political repression. I'm not sure what's caused them to reconsider, frankly, at this point. But I think that the danger here now is not only about doing business in China, but that China is now trying to control the actions of companies, even if they're doing business elsewhere. And you know, the most recent case that we had was China went after a number of multinationals, airlines and hotels, et cetera, that identified Taiwan as a separate political entity on their websites. And China basically said, if you continue to do this, we will, you know, stop your ability to operate in China. And the Trump administration came out and said, you know, we believe this to be a ridiculous, you know, move on the part of China. They called it an Orwellian, you know, action, and urged the U.S. companies not to submit to the Chinese pressure. And one could imagine that if you had a collection of multinationals all in the same space, like all multinational airlines, who refused to acquiesce to the Chinese decision or whatever law, regulation, that China would be forced to take a step back. But instead, they all folded in the end. You know, and so I think that there's a problem of collective action. Multinationals actually do have a lot of power, a lot of sway. China wants investment from many of these companies. They want to do business. Sometimes they need to do business with them. But if you know, companies can't come together to push back, then China has succeeded in that sort of, you know, separating them out one by one. They're much more vulnerable.
In President Xi's attempt to reclaim Chinese greatness on the global stage, as I believe you call it in the introduction to your book, he doesn't seem to pay much attention to the global refugee crisis, which you indeed, toward the end of your book, point out maybe one of the real shortcomings of these efforts by him to be the global leader.
Exactly. And I think, you know, the point here is that you can't simply claim global leadership, right? You can't simply say China is now ready to claim the mantle of global leadership. We are a power on par with the United States, unless you're willing to take action in support of addressing the major global challenges of our time, of which the refugee crisis is certainly one significant one. I'm not claiming that the United States is an actor to follow at this point on this particular issue. Others have done a better job, Germany, for example. But the real point is not to say, it's not simply just because the U.S. is bad doesn't mean that China's not bad too, right, on certain issues. And so I think it's important because the media often are much too quick simply to buy into whatever narrative Chinese President Xi Jinping is sort of casting out there, particularly because President Trump, in many respects, is not particularly attractive on the global stage. So it's easy, right? It's easy to look for a substitute, and Xi Jinping talks about it. He claims it. So why not just give it to him without actually looking to see what is it that he's doing to merit it? And the truth is he's not doing much of anything to merit it. So it may not be that, maybe that the United States is not the global leader that it was or should be, but it's also the case that China is not.
So since you wrote the book, there has been some U.S. tariffs. They've eroded American demand for Chinese exports, left many of the factories that produce those goods in danger of shutting. And while there's a truce and negotiations talking again, what's the likelihood of a deal?
You know, I have to say I was fairly optimistic before the last deal fell apart. So I'm not sure I'm the best person to predict at this point. I thought we were pretty close. I thought we were all but, you know, sort of signed, sealed, and delivered. First of all, there are some different opinions within the U.S. on how tough to be. I think there are some differences of opinion on what the end game is. I think for some, the end game is a level playing field, and that's certainly where I fall, right? I want China to be a level playing field for American companies, and whatever it takes for us to get there, I think, is the right strategy. But I think there's also another narrative in Washington that is these tariffs and other kinds of potential economic sanctions, entity lists, limits on Chinese investment, et cetera, may be enough to, you know, bring the Chinese economy to its knees. And in that scenario, which I think is the wrong approach, but in that scenario, I think there's not necessarily a deal to be had because the end game is not that level playing field, right? The end game is just how far can we push until the Chinese economy, you know, if not collapses, is so seriously damaged, right, that it really poses no challenge. And it's not competitive. So I think there's some concern. And I think on the Chinese side, they too have their own differences of opinion. And I think that their chief negotiator got out a little bit ahead of where some of the rest of the Chinese leadership was. They basically called them back and said, you're giving away the store, and we're not going to allow it. And so you had some pretty significant changes at the last minute to the agreement. And, you know, then all bets are off again. So I don't know what the likelihood is of a deal being reached, because I think that there's not necessarily the perfect consensus probably in either country about what each side thinks it can get out of the other.
Mm-hmm. Well, Elizabeth, your book is just a great treatment of this subject as we look forward into the future at U.S.-Chinese relations. You say in the conclusion of your book that the U.S. needs a deep reservoir of Chinese expertise. Your book, The Third Revolution, Xi Jinping and the New Chinese State, has done just that. It's a great place to start. I urge our listeners to get a copy of it. But Elizabeth, thanks for joining us today, and thanks for the great work you're doing. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks again, Bob.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.